If you'd like to listen to our podcasts without ads, please consider becoming a member. In addition to no ads, members receive bonus content for virtually all of our shows, an invitation to join the DSR Slack community, access to our Discord community, enhanced show notes for select shows, and more. For this week only, get 50% off the first year or the first month of membership. Visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and use code ECLIPSE to receive the discount. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code ECLIPSE. Thank you very much for your support.
Nine, 12, 10, 28, 2, 23.
This is Deep State Radio, coming to you direct from our super secret studio in the third sub-basement of the Ministry of Snark in Washington, D.C., and from other undisclosed locations across America and around the world.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm your host, David Rothkopf. And as you know, every so often we will sit down with an author we think you should hear from, who has a book that we think you should hear from. In this particular case, it's a friend of ours, Miles Taylor, who's got his book, Blowback, which we talked about a year ago, which is now out updated in paperback. He's a national security expert who works in Washington, D.C. He previously served as chief of staff at the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. He's the host of the Whistleblowers podcast, and his book is now called Blowback, A Warning to Save Democracy from Trump's Revenge. And as I say, it's available in paperback. How you doing, Miles?
I'm doing great. And David, it's great to be with you with one big caveat. And that caveat is, I wish we didn't have to change the subtitle of this book. In fact, I wish I didn't have to come chat with you about it at all, because the hope was, you know, by issuing yet another warning last summer that, you know, maybe we would avoid this guy being a major party nominee. And clearly we haven't. And so rather than calling this a warning to save democracy from the next Trump, it has to be from Trump's revenge, because he is the nominee. And the threat we're facing is that he is the next president of the United States. And as we all know, it would be an administration governed by retribution. And so, I've got to be out there talking about that as much as I hate being out there talking about this issue.
Well, when both of us were writing our books a couple of years ago and talking to people in the administration in which you served, there was a common refrain. And it was remarkably broadly held. And that was, it would be a disaster to have another Trump term. And I heard it, and you reported on it, from cabinet secretaries, sub-cabinet members, civil servants, people who were just close to the administration, because all felt that sort of the first term of the Trump administration was kind of a training exercise, where they learned where the impediments to doing whatever they wanted may lay, and how to remove those impediments. Now, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but these are points you make in your book. The only thing I think we got wrong is that it's going to be worse than we thought it was. And I think it's striking how many high-level Trump administration officials opposed him returning to office. And I think it's amazing that he's the candidate anyway.
I hate to use the term, but I've been using it anyway, which I call civic suicidal ideation, because that's what I think we're engaged in right now is, and without even realizing it, we are considering throwing it all away on a man who is so observably unhinged that it doesn't take an insider to come tell Americans that. We observe it every day, and yet we're blowing past all the warning signs and about to deliver ourselves potentially a fatal Democratic blow. That, I think, is as remarkable to me as it is you. And yet here we are, this is where we find ourselves. And I think that that question becomes, can folks issue a warning that resonates with a segment of the voting population that can prevent this from happening? And as you rightfully note, David, in the last go round in 2020, there were enough Republicans and specifically people who had served in Trump's orbit that came out and said, look, here's who the guy is, and we're going to provide air cover for Republican voters out there who decide not to support him, which is actually a hard thing to do. People spend their lives in these political tribes, and it's central to their identity, and they have a hard time pulling the lever for someone of another party or supporting a Democrat for the first time in their lives. And just enough people did that in 2020 to deny Donald Trump the White House. I think the really big question is, will those folks show up again and decide to oppose Donald Trump? What worries me is a lot of the polling shows that those disaffected Republicans, a lot of them have gone back to the tribe. They've gone back to the GOP and they say, yeah, I voted for Joe Biden last time. I don't like Joe Biden. And so I may just have to vote for Trump or sit this one out. That may be enough to put him back in the White House. I think that's the worry. However, the big asterisk here is that since 2020, we've seen even more ex-Trump officials come forward, whether it was in the January 6th investigation and testifying before Congress, whether it's people who found their conscience in the couch cushions and are now offering that up to the American people. But I don't know if it will be enough. And I'm actually curious to ask you, David, what your prognostication is, because I think you're as good of an observer of this phenomenon as anyone.
Well, you're nice to say that. And as far as prognostication goes, I've been trying to avoid that because I've been so strikingly wrong in the past, and got on television many times in 2016 to say that Trump would never be elected, and would come home to my wife, who was from Michigan, and she would say, you know, you're wrong. He's gonna win. And I was like, oh, huh, but I'm a professional. I was wrong. And she's now the one who's in the government. I've learned humility at least a little bit in that regard. I think just to sort of to turn it back to you, one of the things that I don't think people fully realize is how hard it is for people like General Mattis or General Kelly or Mark Esper or Kirstjen Nielsen or Mike Pence or you to say, I can't support this guy anymore. I can't support this party anymore. I mean, Mattis and Kelly and Nielsen and Esper and Pence, you know, these are all people who valued, you know, party loyalty or loyalty to the country, not party loyalty, but loyalty above anything else, and came, you know, to realize that loyalty to the country was more important than loyalty to Trump. But it was not easy. It was a torturous journey. Many of them struggled the whole time you guys were in government with this issue of, how do I do my job in the, you know, chain of command and honor my oath? And for a lot of these people, it's scarred them permanently. I just don't think people fully realize that when all these people come out and say, no, I can't support him, it's a huge deal.
I'd agree with that. And, you know, I don't align with your assessment out of any sense of vanity or pride. I mean, I think it's a lot of folks suffering out there because of that experience. And, you know, a lot of us, it's almost like a quiet support group that exists among the people who spoke out. A lot of those people are still really piecing their lives back together because their lives were destroyed. They lost jobs, they lost homes, they lost relationships and friendships. It bankrupted them. And yet when you ask those people, when you ask some of these peers of mine if they would do it again, almost to a person, they say yes. Now, it's important to retell that, because when we're trying to go out there and convince new faces to come forward, they need to know that, yes, there will be costs. There are costs in this day and age to speaking up. In fact, the price of dissent is higher than it's ever been. But the payoff in terms of the moral relief you feel is something you can't replicate. And you may never have that experience again in your life to stand up on an issue that's so black and white and do the right thing. And that's what I find so remarkable about this cohort, is that despite everything these people have been through, folks would do it again and speak out against him. And again, there's probably folks listening that are saying, you know, come on, I'm not going to play the violin for ex-Trumpers. But it's not just the ex-Trumpers. It's public servants all over the country today who, when they decide to speak up, are on the receiving end, not just of disapprobation, but threats to their lives. I mean, the fact that 30% of poll workers in the United States are scared for their lives to go work the polls is stunning to me. This used to be the type of thing, you know, you go take a day off of work to volunteer and do your civic duty. And now people are seeing it like they're on the front lines of a war, because they're scared of being attacked and they're scared of the crowdsourced death threats. And they saw it in 2020 with the Ruby Freemans of the world. It's gotten serious. It's gotten really hard to be in the public eye in any way, shape, or form, even in your local community. Mayors and state reps are receiving the vitriol as well. And across the board, the statistics show public officials at a higher rate than ever reporting fearing carrying out their jobs in a responsible way. That is not as it should be. And the only way to reverse that tide is for more folks to show moral backbone and to stand up. Cowardice is contagious, but courage can be too. And we need people to be doing that in greater numbers than ever if we're going to turn the tide against political extremism and intimidation.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But I, you know, people like you, people like our friend Olivia Troy, who people know from the media and so forth, had paid a deep personal cost for this and struggled deeply with it and deserve our appreciation. You know, and I don't think, you know, I mean, Liz, as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh, the big movie that's about to come out is called Civil War. You know, and that would have been a ludicrous idea to float, even for Hollywood. But now it seems very real. You know, it seems sort of torn from the headlines. We've moved to a level of division in this country that we haven't seen in 160 years. And the trigger seems likely to be this next election, where if Donald Trump wins, he's going to put into power the worst of the people that were in his orbit the last time around, the Kash Patels and the Rick Grinnells and the Stephen Millers. And all of them have already said, no, there'll be concentration camps. No, we're going to throw our enemies into jail. You know, all of them have essentially said, vote for us, you'll get the constitutional crisis you want. That's what your book is warning of. How real does it feel to you? How close does it feel to you?
It feels imminent and visceral. And I would also paint the picture of another path, David, which is, even if he loses, we can't think that we are off the hook. I want listeners for a moment to put themselves in the ex-president's shoes, as terrible as that sounds, not to give you a real low point in your day, but put yourself in his shoes, the way that he's been acting. He sees winning the presidency as his only salvation, financially, reputationally, but also legally. The man fears, and probably rightfully, that he will be in an orange jumpsuit in prison if he doesn't win the presidency. So if in 2020, he went as far as he did to try to disrupt the transfer of power, now with the threat of imprisonment and financial ruin hanging over his head. Does anyone reasonably think if he loses, he will concede gracefully? I think the reality is we can anticipate, and we should anticipate, a far more serious attempt to disrupt the transfer of power if he loses this election. He has already riled up supporters to engage in armed insurrection that happened in 2020, and he has sort of tilled the fertile soil, if you will, for something like that to happen this go around with his rhetoric. And there are people willing to do it. I mean, we soon forget there were people with loaded weapons in hotel rooms in Washington, D.C. in January 2021 who were prepared to descend on the Capitol and fire in anger to prevent that transfer of power. We're lucky that there wasn't more bloodshed. I have a lot of worry about what happens even if he loses this go-around and the violence that he might incite. This country is a powder keg. Now, of course, David, as you rightfully note, should he win, I think that in a different way, we could see that manifest. One of the first things that he will try to do in office is, of course, he wants to shut down the southern border. The only way that the president can do that without Congress reforming immigration law is to do it essentially illegally with the invocation of the Insurrection Act, the likely deputization of state and local law enforcement and potentially militia forces. Some really extra constitutional things will have to happen and probably will happen in that first month. I think that pushes us into constitutional crisis almost right out of the gate of that administration. I mean, remember, and you and I have talked about this before, you know, it was Stephen Miller that told me to prepare for a shock and awe blitz in a second term. That's how he characterized the first day of a second term. I don't have any reason to think that they're planning something different than a shock and awe blitz. In fact, they've now had 4 years to make sure they're prepared to do exactly that. So I think we need to open our eyes and realize that whether he wins or loses, we're facing a crisis situation. So the question becomes, how do we react? And are the courts prepared? Are public servants prepared? Are people in the Republican Party prepared in that moment to turn against him? And I'm not an optimist necessarily on that point, because we didn't see that happen quickly and easily in 2020. In fact, we saw people say, don't worry, it's just rhetoric. Rhetoric, he's not going to go that far. And then he did. And there was only a brief moment in which they turned against him before they lined back up behind him. So now is the opportunity for people to be putting their public servants on notice that we don't want to go through that as a country again if it happens. And I don't think folks are acting with enough haste.
Where are the ads with each one of these people who were in the administration saying, I don't support him anymore? You know, Liz Cheney's out there. Adam Kinzinger's out there. You're out there. There are a couple other people out there. Mike Pence has said he can't support him. But I want to see an ad over and over and over again that says, hi, I'm Mike Pence. I can't support Trump. Hi, I'm Jim Mattis. I can't support Trump. Hi, I'm Mark Esper. I can't support Trump. Hi, I'm General Kelly. I can't support Trump. I want to see all of them, one after another, standing up. And I haven't yet. Why haven't I?
That's a really good question. And David, I'm going to give you the very blunt answer. I pulled together a phone call, two different phone calls 2 years ago on this question. We had, I don't know, 40 or 50 ex-officials on the private conversation to say, all right, guys, if he's back, are we all prepared to band together to do this? And there was some interest. Folks wanted to form a cohort. There was an awful lot of fear. And keep in mind, this is even among people who've already come out against him. People saying, well, you know, I did it the first time, but now I've got a business. I did it the first time, now I've got consulting clients, and I don't want to upend the apple cart. And that's what has me really concerned this time, is folks are hesitant to come together in a cohort against this guy. And, you know, I don't want to point people out by name. I'm going to give them time to do the right thing. But, you know,
it's April. You know what I mean? It's April. There's not a lot of time here.
And you know, I, on the margins of conversations like you and I are having right now, I actually was just, I spent a good chunk of last week here in New York City meeting with folks trying to urge them to get the architecture in place to do exactly what you just said. There's no reason why Donald Trump should be able to drive to his house in Mar-a-Lago without seeing billboard after billboard of his former employees saying he's a loser, he's dangerous, and we don't support him. Why isn't he seeing that everywhere? Why aren't we seeing that in Times Square? Why isn't that on television in every single swing state? It should be, because those are going to be the most effective voices in denying this man a second term. So, you know, I would love to hear more of your listeners, David, calling for that, and more people generally saying, wait, where are these folks? Get together in one group, attach your name to it, and go speak in unprecedented fashion. I will also say, I think the Biden administration needs to leverage that cohort. Now, they've made some offerings to the group of disaffected Republicans, if you will, the Liz Cheneys and Mitt Romneys and Jim Mattises of the world. But we've never seen anything like this in modern American history of that many officials turning against a president. This isn't a moment for politics as usual to go deploy people as surrogates and send them to events. No. This is a different moment entirely. And I hope that the president is thinking about bigger ways to engage disaffected Republicans in his administration. If I was him, David, I would go out there publicly and say, you know what? I am going to run the first unity administration in modern American history, and I'm bringing some of these people into a second term. You're going to see Liz Cheney in the cabinet. You're going to see Mitt Romney in the cabinet. Sure, the far left might grumble, but that's the type of bold move that needs to be made to go win those Republicans over, keep them away from Donald Trump in a second term. And I hope they're considering something along those lines to show that, again, this is different. This is a really, really, really pivotal moment in American history.
Yeah, I hear you. And honestly, I think that's Biden's instinct. You've seen him do more bipartisan stuff than many people thought was even possible to do. By the same token, something sticks in my gullet about, you know, having to pay people to do what patriotism demands that they do. And that, you know, as we, with an offer, with a job, with this, I think at this point, it's time to step up. And, you know, you worked on the Hill. You worked for, I worked for a congressman who was extremely highly respected, sort of center right, you know, sensible. And what we're seeing on the Hill is a bunch of mice, you know, running, scurrying off into the corner, hiding. Nobody's standing up. You know, what about that?
I couldn't have expected it to get worse than it already was. I mean, there were so many members when I was up there who couldn't stand this guy, didn't approve of the MAGA direction of the party, and yet they would go out there to the microphones and they would toe the party line anyway. It's gotten a lot worse since then. And there's a lot of people who were once considered the adults on Capitol Hill who've now just left. They've resigned their positions. They've been defeated in the primaries, or they're planning to head for the exits after this congressional term. That should concern Americans, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, because a more politically extreme Republican Party is bad for our republic. It makes it harder for compromise legislation, but it also, in these moments of transition of power, is vitally important. And we saw that in, again, it, just after 2020, is you had way too many people in the Republican Party who were willing to aid and abet the frustration of the transfer of power. If you thought that was a radical Congress, statistically, it shows this is a far more ideological Congress and MAGA Congress than we had in 2020. I mean, I worry about that when it comes to, December, January of this year, when we're expecting the Congress to certify the vote. If Joe Biden wins a second term, I feel that we're in for a repeat, but we have an even more radicalized body of Republicans there. That said, there are still a lot of folks, as you say, David, who know better in private, but say something different in public. And I think the only way they're going to learn is to lose in the polls and to lose their jobs for that. And that's up to the American people. The courts aren't going to save us. It's going to be people voting at the ballot box.
Yeah, well, from your lips to God's ear on that point. But, you know, you're also a national security guy like me, like a lot of our listeners, or national security person. A lot of our listeners are women who are leaders in national security as well. And while all this is going on, you also have that crowd of folks listening to Trump and doing something that I just find so astonishing. I'm just interested in your reaction to it, which is essentially embracing the Kremlin line on the most crucial issues of U.S. national security, blocking aid to Ukraine, weakening our last line of defense against a Russian threat against NATO, taking victories and progress that we've made for 2 years, and reversing it, and showing no urgency about it, no concern about it, even though the majority of people on Capitol Hill would support aid for Ukraine. But you know, it goes broader than that, because a lot of the support that exists for Trump comes from Russians still. We have this extraordinary case about his abuse of classified documents, which is currently being managed by a MAGA judge who does not seem to care about national security. And it's not just democracy that's at stake here. The reality is that if you take all these things and you total them up, the Atlantic Alliance is at stake, the Pax Americana is at stake, the things that we've spent 80 years building that people fought in World War II to make possible, it's all going to go. He's the guy who wanted to pull out of NATO. But, you know, his team said that he wanted to. He still is talking about it. We are really going to throw in with our enemies as we become an autocracy. And I'm just interested in your national security guy perspective.
David, I think that there are a few people who have articulated that better than you since 2016. I mean, genuinely, you've been out there sounding that alarm. And I know it doesn't feel satisfying to be vindicated, but you've been vindicated on that by Trump himself, because he has owned up to wanting to do the things that you warn people that he will do. And, you know, starting with the Russia piece, I think to put a very fine point on it, people don't realize that the Russian meddling we're seeing right now is worse than it was in 2016. Worse because they are actively influencing US policy and the actions of one of the two major political parties. In 2016, the worry from senior national security officials and those of us who were read in on Russian interference and the intelligence we were seeing, the worry was that Donald Trump was potentially being manipulated or was benefiting passively from Russian interference. We were worried mostly about one man and how he was reacting to it, and of course the influence on voters. But in the political system, we were worried about one man being manipulated. Now we're worried about an entire political party marching to the beat of the Kremlin's drummers. That is remarkable to step back and to witness that. That is, for the Russians, an enormous success story. Vladimir Putin has been successful beyond his wildest dreams in co-opting Republicans to support his narrative. And keep in mind, this is the same party that Vladimir Putin previously had feared the most. He was less worried about the Democrats and more worried about hardline anti-Putin Republicans in the United States, who wanted to ramp up the pressure on Moscow. He was worried about a new Cold War with the United States because the Republican Party was so anti-Russia. Somehow, in the span of a few years, and much thanks to Donald Trump, that has flipped almost in its entirety. That has real implications for global security. It's not just the Ukrainians. I mean, there's some Americans who say, look, I don't support Putin, but I also don't want us to be involved in foreign wars. And I would disagree with him on other grounds. And we could have a conversation for another day about why it's important for us to back our Ukrainian sisters and brothers. But even if you don't want the United States to be involved in these types of proxy wars, it's not going to end there. By permitting Vladimir Putin to have what he wants in the region, he'll have that and more. If you give a mouse an ICBM is essentially what we're facing with Vladimir Putin. He's going to go further. His goal has always been to break the Western military alliance, to break NATO. And he's now teaming up with the Chinese to make it happen. I mean, as far back as 2011, the intelligence community was declassifying information to show we saw a sort of new axis emerging between Beijing and between Moscow, and also to a certain extent, Tehran. We're now seeing those powers collaborate and interfere collectively to try to undermine U.S. democracy, and it's working. That is the wake-up call we should see here. It's not about Trump. It's not about politics. It's not about Democrats or Republicans. It's about autocratic regimes who literally want to destroy our way of life, our lives and our livelihood and our way of life. That's what they're going after. And we're letting them by being so focused on the trees instead of the forest. So I would agree with you, David. It's one of the most significant aspects of this crisis we're in that somehow is still evading notice. The interference, again, is bigger than it was in 2016, but we've almost become numb to it that we're allowing it to happen. We can't be numb to it because we'll wake up tomorrow and find ourselves looking more like Moscow than Washington, D.C. if we let this continue.
You're so right. I'm so glad to see you out there with this book again, Blowback. I am so glad to have this conversation. I hope we have many others between now and then. Because it's easy to be numbed by 9 years since 2015 of stories about Trump, stories about Trump and Russia, stories about threats to democracy, stories about impeachments or corruption or sex scandals or coups even. It's easy to become numb, and a lot of people have, but it's April. So that gives us May and June and July and August and September and October until November, half a year. And what we could end up with in half a year is not an America that looks anything like what we remember America to look like or what we hope it will look like. It won't be a democracy. There won't be diversity of opinions. People you know will be thrown into prisons for having opinions that differ with the president. People will be thrown out of the country for believing a different religion or looking a different way. Women's rights will be further stripped away. The very, very few at the very, very top will get more and more and more, and everybody else will get less and less and less. And we'll stop supporting our allies. We'll stop supporting peace in the world and democracy and the rule of law, and we'll start supporting Putin. We'll shift over to the other side, the gang of right-wing ethno-nationalist leaders that includes Putin and Orban and included Bolsonaro, includes Bibi Netanyahu, includes Narendra Modi. And all these things can happen literally in the tick of the clock as we go from election day to the day after, unless we pay attention to warnings like the warnings that Miles is bringing and has been bringing for a long, long time. Keep it up. Come back soon. Congratulations on the paperback. And thank you for joining us. And thank you, everybody else, for joining us. Please come back soon. Until then, bye-bye.